Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Paige Mackey-Murray, and I represent the appellant in this case, Tari Vickery. When you read the briefs in this case, you might come to the conclusion that this is a complicated or nuanced case, but actually it's not. It's actually rather simple. So what I'd like to do today is point out four basic things for the court that I think will make this case easier to resolve. The first has to do with the remedial contempt and the resulting attorney's fees. CRCP 107D2 states that in all cases of indirect contempt where remedial sanctions are imposed, the notice that the defendant receives has to include the remedies that the party seeks as well as the possible sanctions that could be imposed. If you look at the notice in this case, the only remedial sanction that's requested, or excuse me, the only remedial action that's requested is that Mrs. Vickery take an affirmative action to return the funds to Mr. Diamond. And then when you look at what the hearing enveloped and what it encompassed, at the hearing, what the court really addressed was the sufficiency of the accounting, and that was the only basis for the remedial contempt in this case. That was not included in the notice, and there's really hasn't been a whole lot of dispute over that. What has been in dispute is the nature of the remedial sanctions versus the criminal sanctions. And remedial sanctions require that a court say, this is what you have to do to purge the contempt, and if you don't do it, you're going to receive jail time or a fine or something like that. And if you look at the court's order, the only part of this case that resembled remedial contempt was when the court said, come back at sentencing with a revised accounting, and if you don't do it, you're going to go to jail. She didn't receive notice of that. And that resolves the remedial part of this case. That also resolves the attorney's fees as well, because attorney's fees can only be granted in relation to remedial contempt. Now, with regard to the criminal part of this case, under criminal contempt, it has a heightened evidentiary standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The order that was allegedly violated here was an order not to act. So in order to violate that order, someone would have to take an action in violation of that order. There was absolutely no evidence here that Mrs. Vickery took any action. There was evidence that she had the power to act, but there was no evidence that she actually took any action whatsoever. Mr. Diamond brought forth testimony and documents both with regard to the Coltaff account and with regard to the Merrill Lynch account. But what's starkly absent from the case is any evidence whatsoever with regard to the U.S. escrow account. There were no documents presented with her signature. There was no one from U.S. escrow was called to testify that they followed their normal procedures in this case. The only evidence that was presented was what those procedures were. But that's not evidence of Mrs. Vickery taking an act. So there was no evidence here to support that part of criminal contempt. The mens rea, you reach that only if you think she actually acted. If she acted, if she signed something, if she transferred the money, did she do so knowing that it violated the court's order? And the only evidence presented was testimony by Mr. McAllister that he did it and that he told her that it would not violate the court's order. Now, Mr. Diamond might argue that this is a simple order and it was very easy to follow on its face and that she couldn't have reasonably relied on her attorney's advice. But this wasn't an easy order. This wasn't a simple order. Both parties requested clarification of the order afterwards. There's language in that order that to this day doesn't really make sense to the parties, and there was this overarching concern that maybe it didn't even apply to her in the first instance.
Didn't Mr. McAllister need her agreement before he could move the money from the escrow account into his Coltaff account?
There was some evidence that the normal U.S. escrow procedures was that she would have to sign for something, but there was no evidence that U.S. escrow followed its procedures in this case. It wouldn't have been difficult to bring in documents with her signature on it or someone from U.S. escrow to testify as to what the procedures were here, but that didn't happen.
She authorized Mr. McAllister to transfer the funds.
I don't think there was any evidence presented that she authorized Mr. McAllister to transfer the funds. The attorney's fees in this case, there's also been a request for attorney's fees by Mr. Diamond, and that request should be denied, first because the remedial contempt, being the only basis for attorney's fees, should be overruled in this case. But also, even if this court doesn't overturn the remedial contempt here, attorney's fees are also not warranted. Mrs. Vickery has a constitutional right to defend herself against a criminal contempt violation. This case would be before this court anyway. And it's not an extra use of judicial resources or attorney resources to include the remedial contempt in here. If any, it's very minimal. Moreover, Mr. Diamond contends that the two are intrinsically related to one another, so it would be difficult to parse them out anyway. And as we said, I think the court exceeded the scope of the original original contempt motion and citation to include the remedial sanctions that it imposed.
Ms. Mackey, if you wouldn't mind going back just a step or two, I want to make sure that I understand your position about the record. It's my understanding that the record indicates that wife had some testimony. She didn't believe that by authorizing Mr. McAllister to move the money into the Coltaff account, that that would be a violation of the order, because the money would nevertheless still be in trust for the plaintiff. If that's incorrect, I'd like your explanation of that.
She did testify, or no, she didn't testify, I'm sorry. She, there was evidence that Mr. McAllister told Mrs. Vickery that moving the money, his movement of the money into his Coltaff account would not violate the court's order. That's correct. And that actually goes to her mens rea and goes to whether or not she actually believed that this violated the court's order. I think the fourth point that I want the court to understand is that the remedial contempt and the criminal contempt portions we just discussed resolve the case completely without considering the jurisdictional and due process arguments. However, if the court feels inclined to reach that part of this case, the decision in Diamond versus Terry Vickery is not dispositive of this case. This case is postured very differently. Mrs. Vickery has directly challenged the alter ego finding on due process grounds, that she was not individually a part of that case and did not get to individually litigate that question. There's a difference between the trust and the partnership defending the corpus and the assets in those entities, and Mrs. Vickery defending her individual status as an alter ego. And so if the court feels it has to reach that part of the case, it should reanalyze its analysis. The alter ego shouldn't be a basis for finding her to not be an indispensable party. And so I think that changes the analysis in that case. And those are the four points. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Kelly, what do you say in response to the argument that there's no evidence whatsoever that the wife took any action, and no evidence that she authorized Mr. McAllister to transfer funds into his Coltaff account?
Your Honor, there's evidence in two places on that issue. One, Mr. McAllister's testimony. Mrs. Vickery did not testify, and we did not have the ability to require her testimony. Mr. McAllister, however, did testify that he spoke with both Mr. Vickery and Mrs. Vickery regarding the transfer, and that after the transfer, I'm not quoting here, so please don't look for this. He was authorized to do this. At the moment, I don't recall exactly how he phrased his very careful testimony. He was dancing as well as an attorney could dance when they're on the stand defending themselves and also trying to protect his client. But in addition to that, Your Honor, in the reply brief filed in this court, Mrs. Zirkery argued that the conduct here resulted merely from her allowing her attorney to transfer the funds. It's that acknowledgement that she allowed it to happen under the circumstances where she was the agent and the general partner of the trust and the partnership. The trust and partnership were obligated in order to freeze those funds, not move them. The brief acknowledges that it was allowed, and that is consistent with Mr. McAllister's testimony, that this all happened after he conversed with them. We did not have representatives from U.S. Escrow. They had, after the deposit of the monies into the account and prior to the hearing, they had moved out of state, and we could not compel them here, and we did not proceed out of state to take their deposition for preservation for the contempt hearing. So we did not have their testimony. But what we do have is a trial court's specific finding, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Mrs. Vickery had acted willfully, knowingly, and intentionally in the transfer of the funds. She acknowledged in her opening brief, as she had to, that the U.S. escrow funds, in fact, belong to the partnership. She knew the funds belonged to the partnership because she signed the escrow document that expressly confirmed the partnership's ownership. That same escrow document required written directions from the partnership before the funds could be released. And those were directions that only she could provide. She had testified in her deposition that Mr. Vickery lacked authority over the partnership accounts, and that testimony was consistent with the partnership documents where Mr. Vickery delegated his general partnership authority to Mrs. Vickery. And Mr. McAllister confirmed that Mrs. Vickery had complete control over the accounts with his testimony that she, in fact, had acknowledged that she was the only one with the authority.
So, Mr. Kelly, was the court's finding that Mrs. Vickery authorized the transfer, was that a finding by inference, by circumstantial evidence, essentially?
Yes, Your Honor. And circumstantial evidence is sufficient. We did not have to have and did not have to produce a letter from Mrs. Vickery. We did not have to produce that. We could provide and produce the circumstantial evidence showing that this was authorized by her.
What is the evidence that she acted willfully? We have here a situation where it appears to be pretty much undisputed that she acted on the advice of her attorney.
Your Honor, I believe it's in a couple places that this constitutes willful conduct. First, the evidence also showed that even after the contempt order was served and the citation was issued, she never directed that the monies be returned and turned over to IIAP. Mr. McAllister testified to that. But as for the willful, Your Honor, her argument is, as you acknowledge, that she was permitted to disregard the order because her counsel told her she could do so.
No. I don't think that's her argument. I think you've mischaracterized it. I think her argument is that her attorney told her it was not a violation of the order. That is, that she was not disregarding it, and her attorney wasn't giving her permission in some sense to disregard it. He was telling her it was not a violation.
And, Your Honor, with all respect, I don't understand how that is different. The difference, I don't understand the distinction because saying I did or did not act because my attorney told me what to do, and I did not think I was violating the order because my attorney told me it was okay. I don't see the difference. And regardless, this court held in Charles Milne Associates, an order issued by a court with jurisdiction over the subject matter and the person must be obeyed by the parties until it is reversed by orderly and proper proceedings. To rule otherwise would be to allow a party to make himself a judge of the validity of orders which have been issued and by his own act of disobedience set them aside. And I'd also refer this court to the holding in People versus Mendro, where the Supreme Court made it clear that a mistaken belief, even if it's based on advice from an attorney, is no defense to the criminal culpability of a person's actions. If she authorized this, and if she allowed it, as she acknowledged in the reply brief, the fact that she was told by an attorney that she could do it does not negate the element of willfulness. It does not negate the mens rea. And this is particularly true here because Mr. McAllister explained how he could possibly come up with this advice. What he said was he didn't think that the U.S. escrow funds belonged to the partnership. And because of that, they could be moved. Mrs. Vickery knew the funds belonged to the partnership. She had signed a document that they had belonged to partnership. She couldn't go along with this facade that somehow these funds didn't belong to the partnership. And paragraph 8 of Judge Munsinger's order was crystal clear. All funds belonging to the partnership were frozen. Didn't matter where they were. They were frozen. And she knew that. And she can't turn a blind eye and say, gee, my attorney told me that it wasn't raining when it was raining. That's not an excuse for ignoring an order and authorizing conduct that on its face violated the terms of the order. If I can also move on and address the issues regarding the contempt and the procedure used. We sought contempt based on two grounds, the transfer of the funds and the failure to provide an accounting. The trial court made no findings on the inadequate accountings. However, the court, after finding that the transfer of the funds violated the court order, said as a remedial sanction for that transfer that he was going to require Mrs. Vickery and Mr. McAllister to provide us with a complete accounting of certain listed assets. And in fact, that accounting produced evidence of more funds. We found some additional funds as a result of that.
So what notice did Ms. Vickery receive that that remedial sanction could have been sought?
Your Honor, that that notice was not in the citation itself. The citation itself did not request as a remedy an additional remedial order. And so then the issue becomes, what is the significance of that? This court in Levin versus Anuna specifically held that this is not an issue of jurisdiction. It's just a matter, and it's an issue of whether the failure to include in the remedy request in the citation, to include a request that there be an additional counting, whether that's a violation of what is called an essential condition of the contempt rule. And the analysis of these kinds of issues is laid out in People in the Interest of Clinton, 762 P. 2nd, 1381. Now, first, I believe this issue is moot. Mrs. Vickery has not identified any prejudice from being ordered to provide the accounting. She's already done it. It's been provided. And there was no prejudice that she has identified from having been ordered to do that which she had already been ordered to do. She was already under an order to provide an accounting. This was a second order to provide it right.
Are the attorney's fees part of the remedial contempt?
Yes, Your Honor, they are. And that issue is not moot.
And if they are part of the remedial contempt, what findings are there that she had the ability to pay the fees?
There was none, Your Honor. To pay the attorney's fees?
Yes.
There was none. That issue was not raised.
Not to pay the attorney fees. I think we misspoke. I think it's the ability to obtain the funds that had been transferred.
There was no finding on that, and it doesn't have to tie to that. The issue on whether she had the ability to perform goes to whether she had the ability to perform, to purge the contempt. To purge the contempt, she had to perform the accounting. And so that would have been the issue. Now, there was no finding on that because there wasn't an issue on that. No one challenged whether she had the ability to perform the acts required to purge the contempt, which is do the accounting.
Let me ask you, even if it wasn't the issue of the accounting was not mentioned in the notice to Ms. Vickery, was the court nevertheless free to order the accounting as a remedy crafted by the court given the circumstances?
I believe so, Your Honor. The issue of the accounting was well before the court. It was before the court. We charged that as a basis for the contempt. And whether I'm going to speculate as to what the court was doing, but the defense was, we thought the accounting, the defense from the Vickeries and from the trust and the partnership was, we thought the accounting we did was sufficient. And the court, by its order, was in essence saying, go back and do it again. Let's not fight over whether you were in contempt for failing to do it right the first time, but let's get it right. And he got very specific about what needed to be done, and it was done.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that the court can order as a remedial sanction something that is not requested in the notice?
Levin versus Anuna, that specifically happened in that case. It was an issue of staining some doors in a duplex and whether the staining that was done complied with the original orders, and the court ordered that it be redone. And that had not been requested in that citation in that case. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that any of the panel has. Otherwise, I'll.
Real quick.
Certainly, Your Honor.
That case you're relying on, is that cited anywhere in your brief?
It was not, Your Honor, and that this issue came up in the reply brief. It's the first time that it was raised, and I can give the court the citation for that. But the issue of the adequacy of the citation on the accounting issue first showed up in the reply. It's Levin versus Amuna, 990 P. 2nd, 1136. This court, 1999. It's A-N-O-U-N-A. I have no idea how to pronounce it. Any additional questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. A few things. First of all, I haven't seen the People v. or Levin v. Nuna case. I contend that we did raise that issue in our opening brief. That was a significant part of our argument. But nevertheless, if you, I need to review that to see if it even applies to this case. Here, having the accounting be a remedy for the transfer of the funds doesn't make any sense. Everyone knew where that $100,000 was. He had already returned $80,000 at the time of the hearing and had testified that he had $20,000. So there isn't a logical connection between the two. If you read the court's order, he specifically said, you know, I'm not concerned about the timing of the accounting. What I really want to know about is the sufficiency of the accounting. And he just took it upon himself to turn this entire hearing into that question. I'm sorry, not the entire hearing, but a big bulk of it into that question. She's prejudiced because she has attorney's fees against her now, and she never received notice that this was going to be a remedy. She's prejudiced because her attorney throughout the hearing struggled with the fact that she wasn't prepared for that question and didn't have access to all the evidence at the time. A couple other issues. The advice of counsel, and the idea that advice of counsel isn't a defense is a little bit of a red herring, because the question is really, what was her mental state? And all advice of counsel is a factor to consider in determining her mental state. There's no real cut and dry rule like you get advice of counsel and it doesn't count or not. And so going down that road is a little bit misleading. The question of whether she's what's authorized. Now, I wasn't able to find that exact testimony, Judge, in the record in front of me now. However, who did she authorize? Did she authorize Mr. McAllister? And she authorized Mr. McAllister. She said, okay, I guess you can do that since you're telling me it's not a violation of the order. This was an order not to act. And in order to be in violation of that order, you have to take some action to violate it. Sitting back and letting someone else violate it isn't enough. Authorized means she has to sign something to make it happen. And the court actually found that she must have signed something since she was the only one who could have moved the money.
Well, why couldn't the court make that finding based on circumstantial evidence and draw that inference based on the evidence that was before the court?
I don't think that there was enough evidence before the court to make that inference. All we had was a document that showed what the normal procedure for U.S. escrow was. That's not enough to prove that she actually did anything.
Well, we know the money was with the escrow.
That's right.
We know that the money got transferred to the COLTAF account.
That's right.
We know that she was a representative of the partnership.
Yes.
And we know that counsel was counsel to the partnership.
Yes.
And we know that counsel dealt with the partnership through her.
Perhaps counsel went and moved the money on behalf of the partnership on his own accord without her doing anything whatsoever. It's up to them to provide the evidence. It's beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's up to them. They have the burden of proof.
Although your reply brief doesn't suggest that.
Excuse me?
The reply brief doesn't suggest that it was done at the whim of Mr. McAllister alone.
I think the reply brief simply states that he took the initiative to move that money without her having to take any action whatsoever. If I said that she allowed him, that means sitting doing nothing to stop him, but that's not enough to have an action in violation of an order not to act. Mr. McAllister, the only evidence they have is that Mr. McAllister is the one who actually moved the money. It's clear that U.S. escrow required written directions from Mrs. Vickery. Written directions. And there's no evidence of written directions here. So she was convicted on an inference, and that's not enough. That's kind of circumstantial evidence is not enough to prove that she took an action in this case in violation of the court's order. I think the last thing I'm thinking of is he was talking about how the case, the order that from the court was extremely clear, and she shouldn't have been able to rely on his interpretation of the order. Whether he was ultimately found to be incorrect in his interpretation is irrelevant to her mens rea. She's not an attorney. She shouldn't be held to that standard. When someone's wondering about an order or curious about an order and they want to know what it means, go to your attorney. That's like a very reasonable act to take. Go to your attorney and find out what their interpretation of the order is. He made some legal interpretations beyond the order that he gave her, like putting it in my trust account, is it still in trust for purposes of this order? He testified that he told her that. So that all goes to her mens rea, whether or not she believed she violated the order. Do you have any other questions for me?
The Levin case is hardly a new case. However, in light of the fact that Mr. Kelly raised it, it's not cited in the briefs, we're going to allow both of you until next Monday to prepare a written letter to us, not to exceed 2 pages as to why or why not Levin is applicable. I think that will answer your concerns, Ms. Mackey.
Thank you.
But we'll give you both an equal chance to assert your positions regarding that case in a letter. You don't have to file it with a clerk unless you think it's necessary. Simply address it to the three of us and make sure we each get a copy.
And for clarification, would we be entitled to cite additional cases that might?
Are we just interested in the Levin against
the one case?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course, taking into consideration, of course, our receipt and consideration of your letters.